It's Friday, June 11th. It's a kind of rainy day in New York where I'm at. My name is Mike Konzel. I'm a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a blogger on financial reform and other economic issues at Hortibaum and New Deal 2.0.
And I'm Tim Carney. I'm the lobbying editor and columnist at the Washington Examiner, author of two books, most recently Obamanomics.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a huge fan of your work, and I love the idea of having lobbying editors in our media space because it has been a very productive space for coverage and storytelling.
Mm-hmm. And Barack Obama did not end lobbying. So
he did not end lobbying.
There's still that going on. So,
and nor did everyone decide to play nice because we had a massive financial crisis and trying to get to the root of the problem. And one of the things we're here to discuss today is a conference committee for financial reform. So a few weeks ago, the Senate passed its financial reform bill. Conference committee started to merge the House and Senate bill together into one bill that both will pass on Thursday, yesterday, and all the real action will take place next week. And I just issued a report through the Roosevelt Institute entitled Getting the Best of Both Bills, which kind of walks people through. A lot of it's already set in stone, and it's also very possible that a lot of it's already been negotiated behind closed doors, but mm-hmm. It kind of gives a sense of some of the narratives that are still in play. And different amendments that are both in the Senate and the House, things that could get removed from the Senate part of the bill or get added in the House part of the bill that would really radically change how the financial system works in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I noticed from I read the paper, I liked it, and the one of the things you didn't address because you're more of a policy guy than a sausage-making guy, but this is really where I think the lobbyists have, in a lot of ways, the biggest levers, because it is behind closed doors, because no politician's going to have their name attached to particular provisions. And this is where I think it's very possible for, from both my perspective and your perspective, and we'll agree on some of these, for the Wall Street guys to come in and mess this up. And I tell some of my friends, if you really like the Blanche Lincoln amendment that was in the Senate bill about forcing the banks to spin off their derivatives, that's not going to be in the final bill. The White House doesn't want it there. The powerful Democrats in Congress don't want it there. And it's the number one thing that Goldman Sachs and the big investment banks object to. So, because of that, that's enough reason to say that's not going to be in there. And I would just ask you, Mike, sort of, I don't know if you share my cynicism, but do you take sort of the cynical, is there a way that you can come up with something that both wouldn't upset the banks too much and would accomplish what you want to accomplish?
Right, right. I agree with you.
Because if it's going to upset the banks, I don't think it's going to end up in there.
Right. I agree with your cynicism that, like, no one gets fired for something, or no one loses their job over something that happens in conference committee, right?
Yes.
This maybe has been strategically delayed to get past certain people's primaries, people associated with derivatives legislation, maybe not. I'm not that much of an insider. And nor do I have a really good theory of how people can enact political change. It's one of the kind of intellectual pieces that I don't have in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
The best I can do is kind of set up narratives, set up stories about what these amendments do, where they help or where they hurt. So the Blanche Lincoln spin-out language, it is a piece of derivatives reform. It basically says that the swap dealers have to be removed from commercial banks. The other part of it, and you hear this more and more, you just heard it from Fed President Honig, we'll put up a link to it, is that it makes resolution authority more credible. That this bill is... This bill does a lot of things, but the core of it is resolution authority. It's basically to allow FDIC to take down any kind of financial firm that's large.
Yeah.
So in the middle of the crisis, according to the standard narrative, one that I largely agree with, you know, the Fed wanted to take over and write down AIG, but it had no legal power. So all it could do was just loan it money. So this is supposed to do that.
And I really like that part of your paper, by the way, that you every provision that you were talking about it in the context of, does this make it the resolution power credible? But I mean, in regular language, that means, are we going to be free from the tyranny of too big to fail? I mean, is that basically the same question that you're asking?
Absolutely, right? Like, so, yeah. So resolution authority sounds great on paper, but we're never on paper. In the real world, you'll have firms that are, you know, aggressively lobbying and aggressively using legal structures to fight this in, you know, dozens or perhaps even 100 countries. You know, you'll have issues where lots of firms will be in trouble at the same time. So this won't
And notably, I think you refer to Moody's saying they don't think this really, the Senate bill really ends the too big to fail problem. Haven't we gotten two Fed presidents basically saying the same thing? So there are people, you know, who seem to know what they're talking about who are worried that that's not a credible end to too big to fail.
Yeah, Shaheen at Nassapur at Huffington Post had this great catch from Moody's Investor Services. So Moody's is incredibly discredited these days, but they are a good viewpoint into what a generic market participant thinks. Like, there's no reason to think they're super smart, but they're a good reason to think they're just kind of like generic dumb guys who are on the market. And they're looking at this and they're saying, they also have another problem where Moody's right now is rating the big banks as if they have a government backstop, because they do. Like, when they rate Citigroup, they're saying this is not going to fail in the next year. The government is incredibly unlikely to fail as opposed to other investments.
Yeah.
So they rate it. And so they have this problem now where they have to pull back that rating and say, okay, now they're going to actually be it's credible that creditors will take a hit and these firms will fail. But they kind of don't want to pull it back because they don't believe it. So,
and S&P has similar, though slightly more complex things that they've written that I've read. Standard & Poor's does a similar thing, and they've said, we're not sure. I mean, from this bill right now, it doesn't indicate to us that we are going to have to downgrade them. It's another way of saying we're not sure that the government backstop's being removed.
Exactly. And this is not just for fun. This is not just an unfortunate side effect. I mean, A bad but no mean extreme scenario here is that if the market doesn't believe that these firms will ever be resolved, that the resolution authority will never be carried out against them, they all become Fannie and Freddie-ish, right? Like, you know, Citigroup, you know, people say, well, Citigroup will never take a hit, so we'll lend it money cheaper. It will balloon
up. Well, but let me ask you this, and this will be my first corporatist point of the day. What form is resolution authority going to take? We don't know that yet. And it could very well, I mean, the most daring provision we have in there is one saying that the secured creditors could lose up to 20% of their debt if they're lending money to a bank that then goes down, if I'm understanding that correctly. So basically, there's still, if you're big enough to get covered by the resolution authority, that does provide a subsidy. It means that your lenders are getting a guarantee and a bailout. This is one of the problems with erecting this system. I'm not saying it outweighs the benefits, but one of the problems with erecting this system is by creating, I don't know if they're using the expression tier one anymore, but this is what Volcker said, and this is what I put in Obamanomics. He said, designating these banks as that big, as ones that are covered, it gives them benefits. That's one of the things that it does. It allows them to borrow cheaper because one of the things the resolution authority will do is pay off the creditors.
Right, right. So there's an amendment that's in the House that's not in the Senate that I think should be put in by Miller and Moore that would actually – it goes towards what you're saying. So it makes secured creditors less likely to walk away with whatever they have, that the FDIC has discretion to say – this is like an AIG problem where – as the firm collapses, it's pulling capital out of other banks, which causes runs to pay off secured creditors. Now, there's a fair amount of debate about whether or not this would increase or decrease it, but it would certainly give FDIC a greater ability to actually collect money to pay off the liquidity they have to borrow. So,
and Arnold Kling, a conservative writer, wrote in National Review his article about why we should break up the banks. One of the things that was one of his lead points was secured creditors need to be ready to lose money. In other words, everybody who's lending money to a big bank has to believe that there's a possibility that they're not going to get paid back. I mean, that kind of sounds like it should be logical, but it's not the case. And until that is the case, and even the Miller Moore thing, I don't know how it sounded kind of modest from your description of it. But yeah, we need to make sure that everybody doing business with these banks, lending money to these banks, has to, you know, have their neck on the line too.
Absolutely. And another thing, one of the reasons I support a pre-funded resolution authority, there's a lot of debate mm-hmm. about this, about whether or not it's a slush yep. fund, et cetera, et cetera. I think you can draw it with enough legal boundaries around it, and they did in the House, to keep it from having that mechanism to it. But what you're really worried about is, so in the Senate, the kind of threshold for they start looking at you is if you're $50 billion. That's when they can kind of mm-hmm. have a little bit more authority to declare you systemically risky. What you don't want is a firm that's $49 billion looking to really get up, so it kind of falls under the heightened scrutiny, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, if they think that this is a better deal than yes. not being that way, like, then you're encouraging people
yeah,
to take
that's,
on
that's
more
that's
risk.
A great point, yeah.
And so it's something that really worries me, even though, like, I support the ideas of this bill. I mean, if it's done wrong, you are encouraging people to try to, like, you know, lean into the risk to kind of get these special deals that are here, if they're special.
Yeah.
So the resolution fund I like because it's a de facto tax. You know, they're not calling it that way, but it says, okay, if you're going to be under this umbrella, you need to pay into a fund that, mm-hmm. you know, supports it. So it makes it a little bit more expensive. The Miller-Moore would increase the cost of secured creditors, or at least it would very much likely do that.
Yeah.
So you would only become larger if there was a really credible reason for you to do it, if there was
yeah.
serious market incentives for you to do it, rather than trying to game a regulatory structure.
No,
so,
and one of the main reasons, and this again, Arnold Kling argues this, and it's right up my alley, is one of the main reasons to become bigger now is to become more important and thus to be more protected by government. And mm-hmm. to gain more political power. And the economies of scale that incentivize a Walmart to become bigger aren't there in banking. And, I mean, at least that's the argument made by people like Arnold Kling and others I've seen, that the being big doesn't really allow for great pricing competition after a certain point. I mean, being super big doesn't. And that one of the primary effects of being that big is simply the political power that you get.
Yeah, absolutely. There's maybe $100 billion is where it kind of taps out. The studies that say that there's sort of stuff past $100 billion all kind of – there are studies that go through 2006 where there's a giant credit bubble. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, it was great to be big because
yeah.
you could, you know, balloon up. And as opposed to, like, a pin factory, Smith's example, if you're
yeah.
if you're big, you can make a lot more pins. If you're a big bank, you might do a little bit better with your risk management. But then you just take on more risk.
Yeah.
Like, you just balloon back up. So you have this problem. And then if that risk management was looser, if it was like AIG was, like, supposed to be your backstop, then it's even worse. So
mm-hmm.
it's a real, like, it's a double problem. So that literature is very complicated. But in general, I think it's all kind of built on sand. Because it thinks that it's like a factory when it's not. It's like something that just
yep.
takes in money and bubbles up on it.
Yep.
So another thing, and you wrote about this as well, and I'd like to thank you for covering it because I think it's an important amendment, was the Collins Amendment. So there's a second thing that I looked at and said, you know, the one problem is bank capital. I mean, this goes back to the beginning and just says, you know, banks, you know, we have fractional reserve banking. We have this system in our country where we insure it. And we say, okay, so this is the mechanism in which payments are done and a bunch of other kind of core utility-like structures for the economy are done. We need banks to hold capital, and we need them to hold a baseline of capital. We need them to hold good capital.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need them to hold kind of made up financially engineered debt. And one of the big problems we had in the crisis in 2004, the SEC basically pulled off the capital requirements they had for the six largest investment banks, which all, you know, four of which went bankrupt, or three or four of which went
mm-hmm.
bankrupt. And so you talked a little bit about the Collins Amendment's lobbying efforts. I'd like for you to recap that if you would mind.
Well, I mean, let me first just say, one of the things that I'm a free market libertarian, but one of the things that I say is, if the FDIC is backing up a bank, and we'll have the debate about abolishing the FDIC later, or if the Fed lending window, I'm joking, we won't really have that debate now, but if Fed lending window is open to a bank, well, I mean, just base it on the FDIC. The federal government is the insurer. The federal government gets to set stuff like capital requirements. That's something a private insurer would do. And so the free market argument here, at least you can't just make it in its purest form. You can't just say Congress shouldn't be setting new capital requirements or making them more strict. No, it's just a prudential question here. There's no libertarian free market principle involved. So one of the prudential questions is, what should the capital requirements look like? Another one is, should it be Congress making this or regulators making this? And it's a very, and again, from my perspective of lobbying and influence, it's a very tricky question, because you write about the temptation of regulators to soften up as there are boom times, thus being pro-cyclical, creating more bubbles, da-da-da. I worry about who's going to write these requirements into the bill right now. Goldman Sachs, for instance, has said, and I think it was Tim Fernholz at the American Prospect who brought me onto this, Goldman Sachs has said, look, we are already meeting, we're more conservative than most of our competitors in the investment bank world. And so if you ratchet up the capital requirements, you are taking away the ability of some of our smaller competitors to play the game they want to play, and they might have to play the game we want to play, and bringing them onto Goldman Sachs turf. I mean, it's sort of a vague general way of talking about it, but, and Goldman, of course, is the number one source of campaign funds in the 2008 election, number one source of campaign funds for for Barack Obama, and they're very politically powerful. We don't have to go over that. Everybody else goes over that. And they see in these capital requirements that it could be beneficial by kneecapping some of their, or I won't say kneecapping, by shackling some of their smaller competitors.
That's an interesting point. So, right. So you could have, when you kind of set a hard fence, like, so the way I view the capital requirements, the main analogy I use is kind of like a hard fencing for how much damage a bank can cause. So, like, yeah. You know, it's a hard rule. It's like a speed limit on a highway.
Yeah,
is a way to think of it. And you know, there are smaller, more nimble vehicles that could go well over the speed limit and be fine.
Yeah.
But you know, it's very. We don't want cops on the road. You know, keep a brutal analogy going to try to determine that in real time. Though of course they do to a large extent in the real world.
Yeah.
So I would think about that, but.
And again, let me, because you and I have sort of gone back and forth on Twitter and stuff about this. I'm not saying that this makes this necessarily a corporatist provision or anything like that, or even that it makes it a bad provision. One of the important points I try to make is I am trying to poke big holes in the president's rhetorical bubbles when he keeps saying, basically, if you're for whatever bill happens to come out of the Senate, then you're for reform. And if you're against it, then you're standing with the big banks. And on the capital requirements provision and many other, that's simply not true. The biggest banks, and sometimes it's investment banks versus commercial banks, sometimes it's credit unions versus banks, etc. But the biggest banks and Goldman Sachs like a lot of these provisions. That's not in itself an argument that these provisions are bad. But it is something to think about, a reason to worry, and it is a proof that what the president's saying, the way he's framing this debate, is simply not true.
Right. It's interesting. So the big thing about the big pushback on the capital stuff is the type of equity that they can hold. We won't get too technical about, but debt trust are basically they can kind of financial engineer debt into looking like equity. And so that's, I know that's where a lot of the large banks are pushing back.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're kind of, some people who are only banks, commercial banks in name, like Goldman, are kind of on, I watch their lobbying efforts on it. The ones where I really worry about them kind of taking good reform and corrupting it to kind of, you know, put in a market structure is the derivatives language, which we'll kind of conclude the current Senate bill with. The House bill was notoriously loopholed in so much as that, you know, they said, you know, everything has to trade on exchange, but exchanges were redefined to basically be the phone networks that Goldman used anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, these, in the Senate bill, there's a lot of debate about whether or not clearinghouses should have access to the Fed window. You know, clearinghouses have stayed open through world wars and 9/11 and Enron and all kinds of things. You know, we don't walk into this crisis thinking clearinghouses really need a Fed backstop, but that's very helpful for Goldman and some of the largest players that it unloads their credit risk because they also in part own these things.
Yep.
So the Bob Lynn at Brookings had a great paper that was about the dealer banks and just said, you know, two things stood out. One is that the whole market is owned by these five largest banks. Like, you know, you can kind of try to say, it's like a vertical monopoly in some ways. Like mm-hmm. there's so much control that trying to legislate to fix one part of it will just help. Trying to fix something downstream to regulate something upstream is not helpful because
yeah.
you know the upstream is really what's controlling this. And so that's one of the reasons why I really supported breaking up the banks and the Safe Banking Amendment.
Yeah.
And he also pointed out, and I think this is crucial, and it's crucial for the bill as a whole, is that a lot of this stuff regulators could do anyway. The Federal Reserve does not lack for discretion or power. There are some things that really need a legislative response, but a lot of, like, the Federal Reserve could require banks to hold more capital.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something they do for a living. It's important that the people kind of step up and encourage them to do this, but the regulators' incentives and the regulators' discretion.
And
then
it's at the heart of this. Who is better to make these rules? And there's arguments for regulators who are experts, who are not vulnerable to the same sort of political pressures, who are working on this full time. There's arguments for letting them do it. And there are changing market conditions, and regulators can be more more flexible and react more smartly, possibly, to changing market conditions. And then you've got politicians, though, who, A, might not – I mean, they're being hit by more perspectives, and not just the perspectives of the people that they are supposed to be regulating. They're not as captured by the banks because they're also answering maybe to insurance companies or maybe to voters or maybe to party leaders or something like – or hedge funds. So there's an advantage of politicians being under political pressure. And there's the speed limit rule that there's upsides if you said, okay, the cops are just going to be allowed to pull you over if you're driving unsafe, and we're not going to set a speed limit. And this is, I guess, what they did or do in Montana. But there are a lot of reasons why we don't do that in most cases. And it's not because we don't trust, because we hate cops or anything like that, or because we think that legislators know the right speed to drive. It's that taking away that discretion takes away opportunities for cronyism and abuse, and it sort of makes it easier, and it makes things more predictable, and it takes away the risk that things will sort of, in Major League Baseball, pitchers sometimes expand the strike zone. They pitch on the outside corner, then slightly out the outside corner, and they end up making it bigger. And you could see banks doing that. You could see drivers doing that with the speed limit. And that's the whole debate. And, I mean, you really would have to know more, much more than I do, about how regulators – financial regulators actually work to address the right way to answer that. And I don't know, I seriously doubt that the Senate and the staffers on the House and Senate side have really thought this through. I mean, because that is the heart of this bill, is not so, it's not, since we're not breaking up the banks, we're not, as you're saying, giving too much more authority in a lot of ways to regulators as much as we're giving them more rules, which could be a bad thing.
Excellent. That was a great summary. It's the regulator discretion makes so much sense in other contexts, and when you pull it back to the financial system that underlines so much, it's kind of shocking how despairing, say, of a situation. So now you wrote a book called Abominomics, which is approaching maybe about a 1-year anniversary, probably when you were seriously writing it. I think you were writing it last summer and then maybe into the fall. And so I would be curious, if you were to re-release it right now and you had had plenty of time and were to write a postscript for it, basically that said, what's happened in the past year, also with a more specific target towards what's happened with financial reform, both in the House and the Senate, what would be some of the things you would talk about?
Well, first of all, I would say, look how right I was about healthcare. It ended up being the pharma bill. I mean, the fact that the House and Senate passed different bills, the House bill that the drug industry kind of liked and the Senate bill that the drug industry loved, and then the drug industry lobbyists come in, they try to save Martha Coakley in the 60 seats. They end up benefiting, though, in the end, from the fact that the Scott Brown won, because the Democrats had to pass a Senate bill, which was a more drug industry friendly bill. And so the attempt by drug lobbyists to save the 60 seat Democrats and then ending up winning anyway because they lost it, that would be a great story to include there. But it really just, it was, I mean, I guess I'm tooting my own horn here, but it was what I said was going to happen, that the drug companies were going to win. The back and forth between insurers and the administration afterwards is interesting, and it adds more texture to that debate as I covered it. On the financial stuff, I was writing when before there was a House bill very early on that, and just spoke about how there were smaller banks who were worried that strict rules on lending, something like a Consumer Financial Protection Agency, that would be like a lot of other big government regulations Obama has supported or put in place, where they're sort of rewarding mass production, rewarding uniformity, and punishing diversity, punishing people who maybe package different products for local needs and different consumers. Of course, you know, financial innovation is a bad word today, so maybe I won't have too much sympathy when I'm saying this community banks wanted to have different sort of financial products, and they're worried they're going to be crammed in. But what I would add on is more how Obama, as I said earlier, has once again portrayed himself as a scourge of the special interests, his opponents as the shills for the special interests. But increasingly, as we're getting drips and drabs, especially from Goldman Sachs, we're seeing that the parts of, as happened with the drug companies, the parts of the bill that they object to the most are getting stripped out. And the only thing left in there, I know that Lloyd Blankfein has said he objected to, was the Lincoln Amendment. And I think that's going to get stripped out. And so these regulations will curb Goldman and the big banks some. And J.P. Morgan might suffer vis-a-vis Goldman, or the hedge funds might gain vis-a-vis Goldman. But it's more about moving pawns around among the big special interests than it is about actually handicapping the special interests. The regulations can act as barriers to entry that can protect the big guys, or they can act as sort of regulatory funnels of new business towards hedge funds. And the hedge funds was the main thing that I would love to – I've written a couple of things about Schumer's relation with them, and I think that needs more exploration too.
Well, excellent. Yeah. So a couple things. So I wrote when the – right before the Senate bill dropped, so that right before Dodd pulled the Senate bill out of negotiation, I wrote a piece that – or when he first released his bill, I wrote a piece called What Would a Goldman Sachs Lobbyist Hate About the Financial Reform Bill?
Yes.
And since then, I don't think I've linked to this, Zero Hedge actually was able to get a hold of internal Goldman documents for the Senate Financial Reform Bill that all was like, you know, minuses and pluses. And the stuff that they were worried about, and I think it came in pretty close, the stuff that they were worried about was the Volcker Rule, which mm-hmm. at the point when the Dodd bill first came out was not very strong. It has since strengthened slightly, and I would like to see it completed with Merkley-Levitt.
And by worried about it, don't mean they don't want it to exist, because a Volcker Rule could be a completely harmless thing, because Volcker Rule could mean a million different things. They worry about a Volcker Rule, about the specific form it could take.
Right. So in its best case, the Volcker Rule would separate out the hedge fund portion of commercial banks from commercial banks. And it also looks likely that it will, since Goldman has become a commercial bank, that there will also be a Hotel California law, which could basically say that even if they want to become an investment bank again, that they'll still have certain mm-hmm. commercial, you can't just unbecome a commercial bank like over a weekend. It's like they became a bank over a weekend. And I actually do think that is something that is not being massaged internally. Now, you could argue that hedge funds love it, but, I mean, they would love it in the sense that there would be less market domination and be more equal competition. Now, I want to talk about that in the context of the CFPA in a second. So the Volcker Rule they were worried about, derivatives reforms more generally they were worried about. The 716 absorbed so much oxygen in the room from the lobbyists. I think the New Republic, I think it was known that New Republic wrote about this, a lot of people have written about this in some sense, is that, you know, lobbyists come in and they only have 30 minutes to talk, and they have to spend 25 minutes on 716 to explain why something that seems sort of harmless is a big deal for them. And so they don't have time to talk about why, you know, foreign exchange swaps should be excluded, but everything else should be included, or why it should expand end user exemptions.
And this is a way for, you know, that progressives can still thank Bill Halter and think that $10 million of union money was not flushed down the toilet, because the primary challenge made Lincoln put this in, The runoff made her keep it in, and even if it doesn't end up in the final bill, which it won't, as you're saying, it kept the lobbyists from tinkering with other things.
Yeah. So. I mean, I try to stay away from too much of the politics, especially right now, but I mean, the Lincoln primary challenge was a game changer. I mean, if you look at what I wrote before that stuff and what I wrote after, like my view of the bill changed overnight. Cause at first I didn't even want to cover it. I didn't think that. I thought it would be like kind of this bidding war on the Senate floor, but it turned out to really give it kind of rallied a lot of people, both the lobbyists and people fighting for financial reform over a clear marker of something that was good to fight for, something that was, you know, something that would actually, you know, reform structurally the financial sector that the current largest players wanted to fight against. One story I actually find very interesting and one I'd encourage you to watch is the end user exemption of derivatives. And this was a story I didn't follow very closely, but at first, and then it slowly sort of dawned on me why this was a story. It was, you know, so you have, long story short, you have derivatives regulation, and all these businesses would show up and lobby and say, we shouldn't be held to these standards. So you would have...
Well, because, okay, for example, an airline that invests in oil or whatever, derivatives to offset to hedge against the risk that their fuel costs are going to go up. And so if you're regulating them, you're getting in the way of their ability to, you know, keep their business running smoothly.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you're a congressman or a senator, you know, airlines just have to say, hey, we didn't cause the financial crisis. Hey,
yeah.
You know, unemployment's already shaky. Why are you bumping up against us? You know, it's very easy to say, yeah, expand that. Why are we kicking them? But you also saw it with other firms that weren't clearly firms that had commodity exposure to hedge. So, and I think one story that's out there is that you see a lot of firms becoming banks that aren't banks. So, like, as people who followed it, GM was essentially a bank when it went on.
Yeah.
Like, it was basically the only profitable part of it was lending money to people. Yeah. And you know, auto dealers are exempted in the House from consumer protection. That's not a coincidence. Mm-hmm. The Vitter's Amendment in the Senate basically excludes General Electric, which was the largest issuer of commercial paper in 2007 and a huge subprime conduit of lending. Like, they funded a huge amount of the subprime market in the Northeast. Though it's General Electric, they make light bulbs and have lucrative defense contracts. Like, this is, you know, like, why is this happening? And why aren't they being folded under the regulatory umbrella? So that kind of weird nexus between the Fortune 500, like these kind of, you know, ex-manufacturing or firms that, you know, used to be these kind of like mid-century manufacturing firms, but are now these kind of weird financial firms, is one story. And the other story is, the stuff they're doing with derivatives, I think, is shadier than we understand. So, you know, after the 2005 bankruptcy bill, which is, you know, you think of it as a consumer bill, and it mostly is, but there's also stuff with the way derivatives are treated under bankruptcy. You know, if you are a furniture manufacturer and you have a wood contract, you now call it a wood swap. You know, you call it a derivative, even though there's no real mechanism for it to be a reason for it to be a derivative, solely to game tax law and solely to game accountancy law.
Yeah,
or at least a large part to do that.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of weird, in the same way that, you know, you think of the financial crisis about, you know, the largest investment banks, it's also kind of a wake-up call the way financialization has impacted all of the, you know, companies in the country. So that's one thing.
I think financialization is an underused word, but, you know, we always joke about what we can and can't securitize. And it was Enron that got me thinking about that. I mean, they would sign a contract, you know, we're going to provide power to you for whatever. And then on their books, they would count that rather than as the income that was coming in each year. By signing that contract that year, that had a net, you know, a value of whatever. They'd mark it to market right away, and everything was securitized. And, yeah, it creates... It allows for lots of game playing in ways that have proven to not be harmless.
Isn't it weird that when you think back to the 2000s, that WorldCom and Enron aren't even our biggest scandals? In any other decade, like, they'd be massive, huge scandals, but now they're just kind of like rounding errors in our capacity for shock, I think.
But as far as who's covered by different parts of this regulation, and Obama, this is one of the places where he gets sort of he gets worked up, saying, you know, don't think that you can avoid this just because you're a bank. But if you think about it, that sounds kind of crazy. If you're not a financial institution, why are you going to be covered by this bill? You're pointing out that maybe everybody's becoming a financial institution. I'm a financial institution because I have a mortgage. But for example, dentists. Are dentists going to be covered by the Consumer Financial Protection Agency because they take payment in installment plans? Everybody who gets braces for their kids almost, you know, finances it through a financial product more or less with the dentist. Is that going to be covered? What sort of burden is that going to place on a lot of businessmen? And this is the argument that the Chamber of Commerce uses about the CFPA is this is going to become, this could become this crazy rogue cop policing everybody's business on anything that looks like finance, layaway plans, you know, and maybe there should be more regulation of rent to own. I mean, I don't think there should be more regulation of rent to own, but maybe a lot of people think there should be. But all sorts of businesses could get under the thumb of this new powerful agency, and that terrifies a lot in the business community.
Right, right. The classic one that Chamber of Commerce falsely brought up was those rebate coupons. So, you know, like, mail this in for a free $10. And is that going to suddenly need to be vetted by, you know, a bunch of bureaucrats? Mm-hmm. And no, they really were consciously aware of this going into it. And they were also very conscious of the optics of that. And so there's a lot of, carve-outs for small businesses, for tax accountants, for auto dealers, mm-hmm. which auto dealers I think is actually a big deal because of the way they're securitized. I think there needs to be eyeballs there from regulators. CFPA in practice was really consolidating regulation that already exists. So you, like, everyone does consumer protection, like 10 agencies, but it's all the third mm-hmm. most important mission. Now, you could mm-hmm. argue that there's a fair amount of regulatory uncertainty there. You know, it's better to have one person clearly defined goals that does things and you know what they do rather than the OCC or OTS might wake up one, or the OCC is classic, it might wake up one day and decide to break all the consumer protection laws in Georgia, which it did in 2003 because the ratings agencies asked them to. So, you know, and it's because consumer protection really wasn't their goal. I mean, it was something that they were tasked with and that they could subvert that goal for corporate assent through the mm-hmm. through the preemption stuff and all other state stuff. CFPA is interesting because I'm going to take a quick minute here and take a quick detour. George Stigler, who kind of is one of the economists associated with Milton Friedman of doing public choice and criticizing the state's role in regulation, I went back a while ago and read a bunch of his stuff in the 60s. And one of his biggest targets was the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the Securities and Exchange Commission is basically like you can't lie when you issue securities. You have to consistently disclose to your consumers, and you need a third agent to sign off on it. But they just, like, they hated it. And it's like 1964. If you are an enemy of corporatism, like, there's all kinds of low-hanging fruit for you to go fight over. But this mm-hmm. is a fairly obscure thing to try to whack on. And reading it some more and kind of looking at other parts of the history, my conclusion of it, and this might be a little unfair, is that it is ideologically challenging to them because it says that without the government's role in enforcing transparency, without the government's role in kind of leveling the playing field for how people can negotiate financial contracts, you're going to have a system of, let's just say exploitation. That's probably a stronger word than economists would use. But mm-hmm. you have a system where, you know, you need people to have good information. And, you know, if you're a Chicago person, if you're a libertarian, you would say, well, you know, the market takes care of it because the price is efficient. You know, it's already efficient under kind of Keynesian mechanisms, et cetera. But I think it's a really kind of powerful vision for the role that I like to see government play in financial markets is to say, it sounds weird.
One of my problems with one of the things about the SEC, I hate it when, and this isn't just the SEC, but a lot of these regulations, and listen for it as this bill gets passed, restoring investor confidence. That's not the government's role. That should be the role of, you know, Charles Schwab and the company who wants you to buy their stock and the mutual fund dealer who wants you to buy their – they should be the ones restoring investor confidence. And I think one of the effects of the SEC is to make people feel more end of, you know, Roth IRAs and all the – and the talk and the Republicans talk about ownership society too. I think before – both the you know, 02, 2000, and 2008 stock market downturns, people felt irrationally confident and safe in the stock market. And that's, I think, partly the fault of government agencies that kind of put this veneer of safety. It is safe to go in here because you know this, because the SEC has approved of it. And it's not. It's not safe to go investing. You can't say, oh, well, it increases 11% annually every year, so I'll throw my money, and people get burnt doing that. And then they go ahead and they want, you know, more regulation, more bailouts, more government. So that's one thing, the flip side of what you're talking about, that promoting, that protecting consumers sometimes is more about making consumers feel protected than actually protecting them.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, so there's a couple of things that's interesting there. One is that a lot of that problem is the ratings agencies, which is like a something that we could, mm-hmm. should spend hours and hours. Everyone should spend hours and hours beating on. But,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. We'll put a link to it. But Frank Partnoy is this amazing accountancy professor in California who has written a bunch about financial markets and kind of the problems with them. He did a presentation at this conference we hosted at Roosevelt, and he put a balance sheet on the screen, and he was like, this is a real balance sheet, 2005 to 2009, and it looked incredibly stable, like assets, liabilities, and equity, and you would kind of conclude it was like Coca-Cola or McDonald's or something that's just like this kind of like granny stock that's like always just mm-hmm. kind of making its profit, and it turned out it was Citigroup, and the reason why is because all this stuff was off balance sheet, all this stuff was hidden in the footnotes,
yes.
and... The question is that does that require a government response, or is that something that the market can take care of? Now, it's a good question about the SEC here, because you were on the Chris Hayes show, the Rachel Maddow show with Chris Hayes.
Not yet.
I am not. They should give Chris
his own
show.
You were on right after me, I think. So.
I was. That was we have to thank Chris for giving love to the blogging heads community. But Rachel should keep her show, and they should give Chris an additional show. But you were talking about the regulation, and you had this great line about how, you know, lefties complain about these agencies becoming corrupted, but they were born corrupted.
Yeah.
They were like corrupted
yeah.
in the womb. And and my boss Rob Johnson sometimes says, you know, the Federal Reserve's not corrupted. It was always there to protect the interests of banks. Like,
yes.
you know, this we shouldn't like wake up one day and say, oh my God, the Federal Reserve's only looking out for banking interests, because like that's sort of what they do.
Yes.
And it is kind of interesting. I do have hope for the SEC. Like, I do look at the problems of 2008 is that the SEC did not have, and other related agencies, did not have the means to really get serious balance sheet disclosures, and that they were kind of mm-hmm. trusting that the market was able to aggregate this information, because that's the ideology they were working under. But, there is a critique that says, you know, they're there to kind of put a veneer on what's going on in the financial markets. And that's a left critique, too, in some sense.
Yeah. Yep. We should probably wrap up soon. One of your favorite topics, though, that I wrote about this week, my column today, actually, on Friday, is the interchange fee on debit cards and credit cards. And we won't get into the weeds, but basically, you know, you spend $10 at Walmart, and something like, what is it, 30 cents goes to Visa, which then gets divided up between Visa and the bank that issued you your debit card. And the Democrats have been talking about, for a couple of years, about regulating that fee, either setting it or, in this case, Dick Durbin has an amendment to allow the Federal Reserve to set the fee on debit cards particularly. He's not touching credit cards in this particular measure. Durbin tellingly said, I think it was on the Senate floor, said, I got a phone call from the CEO of Walgreens, and he said this is his second biggest expense. Walgreens, of course, is like it's one of the top, it might be the number two retailer in the country, I don't know. It's one of the biggest companies in America, and we're passing regulation bills to try to cut down on the expenses of Walgreens. And I pointed out in my column that Walmart has been one of the lead forces lobbying for price controls, not on themselves, obviously, but on their dealers, the credit card companies. And so it's another one of those provisions that will get portrayed as you're either with the banks and the credit cards or you're with the people. But no, it's really you're either with Walmart and Walgreens or you're with Visa and Bank of America. And my proposed solution here is not to regulate those, but to allow something that's currently prohibited, which is to allow all the retailers to get together and become a cartel, you could call it. I'll call it collective bargaining, and say, we're not going to pay your fee. And if you you're going to not give us the price we want on the interchange fee, then we'll figure something out. We'll start our own electronics payment system. We'll go without electronic payments for a little bit. And that would be a free market reform that would help the retailers drive down the prices without needing Dick Durbin and the Federal Reserve coming in to Walmart's rescue.
Right. Now, don't you think that allowing the collective bargaining thing would be obviously, it would have the same problem where the people who could most exert pressure are going to be Walgreens. It's not going to be me as a new realtor.
Yeah, no, and interestingly, Walmart does pay a lower interchange fee, I'm told by the banks. They pay a lower interchange fee than other retailers. So Walmart has the least to gain from the collective bargaining, because right now they have an advantage over smaller retailers, but apparently they're still interested in preserving getting rid of the antitrust restrictions on the retailers.
And well, so,
yeah, it could be Walmart they think that they can they already are allowed to drive down the interchange fee. They want to be able to team up with other retailers to drive down the interchange fee more. I don't exactly see the angle there. I mean, what are you suggesting?
So a couple things. One thing that I and perhaps over-focus on in the Durbin Amendment is it allows for discounting for debit. So there's cash, there's the debit where you put in your PIN, and then there's mm-hmm. a credit card, and especially if you use rewards card.
To be more precise, it forces the card issuers to allow retailers to discount for debit.
Absolutely.
Go on.
Right. Businesses can offer you a cash discount. They can say if you pay in cash, we'll give you a free loaf of bread. There's a lot of debate about how much they can actually do that, how much the credit card companies can pressure them. But businesses don't really want to do that. I mean, cash is kind of a pain to carry. Employees steal it, yada, yada, yada. But they would, many would love the option to, let's put it that way, mm-hmm. offer you a discount for using your debit card. Practically, for viewers at home, if you would go to the grocery store, a grocery store might want to offer you a free loaf of bread if you type in your PIN number. They might want to give you an exclusive lane for a PIN number. That's because the PIN that they pay is almost, it's not at par, but it's much lower right now than a credit card. It's particularly lower than a rewards credit card. So because the company is, your grocery store is no longer subsidizing your airline travels through basically paying you an infrequent flyer miles. So they would love to be to allow, they'd love to be able to innovate kind of incentives to nudge you into doing debit purchases. If you are slightly aligned with behavioral camps and you think perhaps all the way credit cards work in our country incentivize you to overuse them and maybe make cognitive mistakes that, cause you to pay late fees, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Then you're worried about overusage of credit cards versus debit cards anyway. I don't know if I'm terribly moved by that argument, but I do think there's a there to it.
Yeah.
I'm on a phone here. I don't know. Anyway, so the question I think fundamentally is this is the payment system. So this is not Subway arguing for the price of bread with, the bread makers.
Yeah.
This is the means for which we're going to kind of have a 21st century economy. It's going to be much more plastic. It's going to be much more electronic. And one thing is that we simply don't know how it works under the hood. Like the Federal Reserve has no means to observe it and know what's happening there. And I think it is appropriate, given that it's like cash, it's the new cash, that we do have some sort of regulatory umbrella on it. Now, if the Fed was – and I'm – really excited about the idea of the innovation coming and incentivizing debit usage. I think it will be good for consumers and good ultimately for businesses. And that's what I would like. I would like to see that emphasized more than the Fed saying, we have to use this weighted rule like Australia used to mm-hmm. precisely set it. So that is my optimistic case for the Durbin Amendment.
All right. Well, we're at about 50 minutes, so we should probably wrap up here. But I want to encourage everybody to read what Mike's been writing on the policy stuff here. He's a generally disagree with him, even if I've been fairly agreeable in this blogging head. I generally disagree with a lot of his calls for regulation, but his description of the policies, description of the problems are very good.
And same back, I'm a fan of T.P. Carney's, and I encourage people to go check him out. So thank you guys, and thank you, sir. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.